This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself. And no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And he it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that he might try you by what he has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and he is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
These are our headlines. North Korea flexing its military muscle with a ballistic missile launch shortly after U.S. and South Korean envoys discuss its nuclear program in Washington. Less than 2 months after the chaotic U.S. withdrawal and the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan, Washington's special envoy is now stepping down. Plus, Muslim scholars from around the globe are getting together in Tehran to forge bonds and share their thoughts on challenges facing the world of Islam. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, South Korea's military says North Korea has fired at least one ballistic missile into waters off its east coast. The North has not officially confirmed the launch, but it comes shortly after U.S. and South Korean envoys met in Washington to discuss their standoff with the North on Monday. Spy chiefs from the U.S., South Korea, and Japan were reported to be meeting in Seoul on Tuesday as well. Meanwhile, U.S. Special Representative for the North, Sung Kim, said Washington seeks diplomacy and has no hostile intent toward Pyongyang. The U.S. and some of its regional allies have condemned North's missile launches. The North says, however, that its nuclear and ballistic missile programs are essential to defend the country against a U.S. invasion. Talks aimed at denuclearizing the North collapsed in 2019 after Washington failed to lift sanctions. Our correspondent in Seoul, Frank Smith, says North Korea has lost faith in the U.S. as a negotiating partner.
The Hanoi summit was a tremendous, really, failure for everyone involved, in particular North Korea. North Korea lost faith in the U.S. as any type of negotiating partner. If we go back to the Trump administration and the number of international agreements that Trump really broke, that 2019 Hanoi summit is really a held out as a prime example, where North Korea was willing to negotiate a reduction in its nuclear weapons programs, but the U.S., you know, took a hard line and basically walked away from those talks, and leaving North Korea really with nothing. North Korea is going to continue on the path of developing more and better a nuclear deterrent, unless the U.S. comes forward with something to offer to bring North Korea to the negotiating table and, again, draw down the tension on the Korean Peninsula.
Moving on to Washington, where political fallout from that messy withdrawal from Afghanistan is haunting the U.S. administration almost 2 months later. The U.S. Special Envoy for Afghanistan is now stepping down from his position. In his resignation letter to the U.S. Secretary of State, Zalmay Khalilzad admits that the deal he brokered between Kabul and the Taliban on a peace process, in his own words, didn't go forward as envisaged. The U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan was part of that agreement. But the Afghan government collapsed and the Taliban took over in just a matter of days as U.S. troops left. Many current and former U.S. officials see Khalilzad as the face of one of Washington's worst diplomatic failures in recent memory. Joining me to discuss that story further is Barry Grossman. He is an international lawyer joining us out of Bali. First, I want to hear your thoughts on Zalmay Khalilzad's resignation.
Well, you know, there's a big question mark over why he's going. He certainly has always been fully committed to promoting U.S. hegemony. He was the U.N. ambassador to the U.N. under George W. Bush. Under various other administrations, he's been the ambassador, alternatively, to both Afghanistan and Iraq. He has, in the past, stated his full commitment to using military force to promote U.S. hegemony in critical zones. And back in 2001, he advocated providing support to the enemies of the Taliban. He was involved for his political career in supporting Brzezinski, in Brzezinski's efforts to create the Mujahideen fighting force that resisted the Soviet invasion and could go on. So it's rather odd that he would be going out, but for the fact that he means by his recent statement a little more than the obvious that the deal didn't go ahead because it envisioned the Taliban not entering Kabul when in fact they did. I suspect there's a lot more that he would like to say. He has indicated that he will say more in the coming weeks. And I suspect that won't be limited to that throwaway line, which stands on its own as being very obvious. So we come back to what other conditions were not fulfilled, and I suspect by the United States itself. Meanwhile, Afghanistan, you know, once again, the U.S. and the world seem to have missed a great opportunity. Afghanistan has been forced into isolation once again. You have no end media campaigns essentially trying to make an issue about a religious come cultural view about the status of women in Afghanistan, notwithstanding that that subject matter has never under international law been grounds for intervention, let alone military intervention. The United States has essentially stolen what existed in the Afghan treasury, throwing Afghanistan into a very difficult position. And you have all of these people running around, mostly in Kabul, prepared to go on record with Western media making statements that are critical of the Taliban, because no doubt in the minds of many people living in Kabul, they've come to associate embracing U.S. cultural values with the prospects for getting money and maybe even a green card. So it's very difficult to get a handle on what Afghanis generally feel about the current situation, to what extent there really is a genuine broad-based opposition to Taliban policies, for example, on the status of women. But what is clear is that the United States itself didn't stick to the timetable to withdraw. I would suspect that while military forces, conventional military forces have withdrawn, that the considerable CIA assets remain in place. And in the meantime, of course, we have the rise of ISIS suddenly, not to mention this self-proclaimed Afghan National Resistance Organization with very clear ties both to the Champs-Élysées and to the U.S. and the U.K. With their erstwhile self-declared leader having indicated his complete willingness to take the fight to the Taliban, something which no doubt sounds very good in the ears of those people who work in the defense industry and have managed to milk this tragedy that went on far longer than it needed to. In fact, one would say it probably should have never happened in the first place in order to line their pockets to the tune of trillions of dollars. So it's not over yet. but I wouldn't count the Taliban out or down, and certainly there's plenty of room without the U.S. interfering for regional discussions to take place that allow peace to prevail in Afghanistan in a manner which doesn't create a security risk for its neighbors, including Pakistan and Iran, and in a manner which doesn't bring the people of Afghanistan back to the very worst of what some people thought represented the Taliban back before 2001.
Yeah, Mr. Grossman, you just said, despite all that chaos that the U.S. caused when they were present in the region, and the chaos that they left in the wake of their withdrawal, Zalmay Khalilzad says that the deal he brokered between Kabul and the Taliban didn't go forward as envisaged. This is abhorrent. How do you comment on that?
Well, this is the big question. He hasn't given any details. He hasn't said he will speak to the matter in the coming weeks. The media seem to be trying to spin this as simply being a throwaway reference to the obvious, namely that the deal called for the Taliban not to press their way into Kabul. But that hardly needs to be said, and it certainly wouldn't warrant him stepping down as the U.S. consul or the U.S. Envoy to Afghanistan. So I expect there's a whole lot more to it. What he specifically has to say on the subject about why the deal didn't go ahead as agreed will have to remain to be seen, but it certainly seems to have played a role in him stepping aside so his assistant can take over the role. Having said all of that, he's not an individual who I look to get reliable information about Afghanistan or just about anywhere else because of his frequently stated commitment to U.S. military intervention for the purpose of spreading U.S. hegemony through critical regions. But to answer your question, we'll have to wait and see what he actually meant. I certainly doubt very much that he was only referring to the fact that as it played out, the Taliban did in fact enter Kabul because the government ran away. He may have something to say about U.S. drone attacks basically murdering entire families right in Kabul itself. There may be other things that he would like to say. We'll have to wait and see what those are.
Thank you so much for joining us. I've been talking to Barry Grossman. He is an international lawyer joining us out of Bali. Hundreds of Muslim scholars and thinkers from around the world are participating in an international conference on Islamic unity that started in Tehran just hours ago. Several dozen guests are in the Iranian capital in person, while the rest are attending virtually. Guest speakers from more than 50 countries will make speeches during the six-day event. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has just delivered his keynote speech. Forging peace and unity in the Muslim world and refraining from discord and conflict are the main themes. Fighting extremism and terrorism and prompting respect, or promoting, I should say, respect among different schools of thought are some of the topics that will be highlighted. The idea of holding the annual event was initiated by leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. This is the 35th time the conference is being held. The Ansarullah movement accuses the U.S. and Saudi Arabia of committing, quote, the most horrible crime since Riyadh began its war on Yemen. Abdul Malik al-Houthi was addressing Yemeni people amid nationwide rallies held to celebrate the birth anniversary of the Prophet Muhammad. He said Yemenis will continue the resistance against Saudi-led aggressors until the full liberation of their land from occupiers. Saudi Arabia, backed by the United States, launched a devastating war against Yemen in 2015 to reinstall the country's former Riyadh-friendly regime. The onslaught has led to the deaths of tens of thousands of Yemeni people, most of them women and children. Yemenis have gathered in the capital Sana'a and other cities across the country to celebrate the birth anniversary of the Prophet of Islam. Abdul Latif al-Washili has more in this report.
Despite the harsh living conditions caused by the years-long Saudi war and siege, thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of the capital Sana'a and 13 other cities to celebrate the Prophet Muhammad's birth anniversary.
Today, the Yemeni people mark this occasion and tell the world that we can overcome all challenges by trusting God. Despite suffering from brutal aggression, suffocating siege, and limitless conspiracies, Yemenis have managed to achieve victories.
Yemenis said they gathered to send a message to the world that Islam is the religion of peace and so it's a prophet. They called on other Muslim nations to mark this day to renew their loyalty to the Prophet Muhammad.
Islam is a religion of peace. Our nation will stick to its identity and values regardless of wars and aggressive policies. Problems have only strengthened us in the face of the enemies of Islam.
For centuries now, Yemenis used to mark the Prophet Muhammad's birth anniversary as part of their religious culture. Such ceremonies include various cultural and religious events, like reciting verses from Holy Quran.
Dressed in green, the color of peace and mercy, Yemenis celebrate the birth of the Prophet Muhammad, which is a great blessing for the whole humanity. People, he say, Muslims around the world should follow the footsteps of the Prophet and stand against the enemies of Islam. Abdul Washali, Sana.
Leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, and his wife Zinat have sued the Nigerian secret police for withholding their passports. Then Juma Abdullahi has the details from Abuja, the Nigerian capital.
Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife Zinat are asking the Nigerian court to enforce their fundamental right to movement by ordering the Nigerian Department of State Services to release their passports. The case filed by Zakzaki's lawyers at the Federal High Court, Abuja, indicated that the secret police have placed a red flag and travel restrictions on the passports of Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife.
We made several frantic efforts to get his passport back from them, so that now the trial having been concluded and they having been discharged and acquitted, we made requisitions to the states to avail them their passports so that they can, as free citizens, travel out. But the states turned down this request.
Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife Zinat need their passports to travel for urgent medical treatment abroad. Zazaki's lawyer said that placing restrictions on the passports of the Islamic cleric and his wife constitutes a threat to their lives. The case has just been filed and will only come up for hearing when it has been assigned to a judge. But Zazaki's lawyers are optimistic that the hearing will commence soon.
The Fundamental Right Enforcement Procedural Rules enjoins that a matter of this nature, which is exigence, should be heard within 7 days of filing. So we're very optimistic that very soon we'll get a date in court and we'll get a case heard and decided one way or the other.
Zazaki's supporters said the action of the secret police is unconstitutional.
Denying Sheikh Zakzaki his passport or restricting him to have a new one. In essence, the government is indirectly telling the world that they have stripped Sheikh Zakzaki of his citizenship, which is completely wrong. He didn't commit any offense to warrant that.
Sheikh Zakzaki is reported to have a dangerous and an unusual amount of lead and cadmium in his blood when he was shot by Nigerian security forces. His doctors have since advised that Zakzaki be immediately hospitalized to remove the dangerous substances from his body. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Well, that's your war news for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
the supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
Unity Week. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. We are in the Unity Week. This week begins on the 12th and end on the 17th of the Islamic month of Rabiul Awwal. It was Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, who named this period as the Unity Week to unite Sunni and Shia Muslims. The Sunnis believe that the 12th of this month is the birthday of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, while Shias maintain that the Prophet was born on the 17th of the month of Rabiul Awwal. Please stay tuned for the first part of the special series on this occasion.
Thank you.
Everyone needs a perfect and sure role model to reach sublimity and lofty moral virtues. According to the Quranic ayahs, the best role model is the messenger of mercy, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. No doubt, following him will help us achieve true life. The Prophet of Islam was not negligent of God's remembrance even for a single moment. It is narrated that when he stood for prayer, his face would change, and there would be heard a sound from his chest and throat like that of scared people. The Prophet's wife said, "When we were speaking with the Messenger of God, as soon as the time of prayer arrived, he would change in a way as if he hadn't known us." God addresses the Prophet in ayahs 162 and 163 of Surah An'am of the Noble Quran, saying, "Say, indeed my prayer and my worship, my life and my death are for the sake of Allah, the Lord of all the worlds. He has no partner, and this I have been commanded, and I am the first of those who submit to Allah." God makes it clear that the element of the Prophet's success is that he was lenient, tolerant, and kind-hearted. He was not aggressive toward masses. In ayah 159 of Surah Al-Imran, we read, "It is by Allah's mercy that you are gentle to them, and had you been harsh and hard-hearted, surely they would have scattered from around you." Imam Ali, peace upon him, says, "The hearts of the righteous were absorbed toward him. The locks were gazed at him. God buried old grudges by him, extinguished the burning flames of enmity, brought hearts close to each other, and made people brothers of one another." Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, used to behave people in a way that their personality was respected. It is narrated that when a person came to the Prophet, he would never look down upon him and would never allow others to humiliate him either. He would give him the best part of his house. If he had a guest who had no mat to sit, he would spread his abaya for him to sit on. Famous historian Ibn Mas'ud writes, "One day a man was speaking with the Prophet, but he was shivering as the awe of the Prophet had impressed him. The Prophet noticed the matter, so he told the man, 'Take it easy, my brother. Feel at home. I am not a king.'" History bears witness that the Prophet of Islam lived the life of the lowest strata in the society. According to some narrations, he would avoid eating wheat bread as it was not accessible for most of the people at that time. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, said, "The Messenger of God never ate wheat bread and never ate barley bread fully." Dear listeners, barley bread and dates were the Prophet's usual food. He used to darn his garment and shoes. Although he had a simple way of living, he considered wealth as necessary for society and economy. He said, "Legitimately gained wealth is so good for a righteous man." Another aspect of the prophet's simple way of living was that never allowed his gathering to have high and low positions. He would make his companions sit in a circle so that everyone was equal. His close companion, Abu Zar Ghifari, said, "The prophet used to sit among his companions without any privilege, so that if a newcomer came, he would not recognize the prophet unless he asked. Later on, he allowed us to build a platform for him from stone and mud so that he would sit on it and we would encircle him." Consulting others is one of the important orders that have been mentioned in the Quran. It is so important that God tells the Prophet in Ayah 159 of Surah Al Imran, "And consult them in the affairs, and once you are resolved, put your trust in Allah." For sure, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, was the absolute intellect and was not in need of anyone. Yet, through consultation, he pursued two goals. First, he wanted to hold his companions in great esteem, and secondly, he taught others to shun egotism and dictatorship. At the end of this episode, we congratulate the Prophet's birthday and recite this ayah together. Indeed, Allah and His angels bless the prophets. O you who have faith, invoke blessings on him and be fully submissive to him.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Does have tied to Muslim extremists, I don't know. What's the worst nightmare for an intelligence agency? The moment its spies start to disappear. The agents and sources, so carefully recruited and nurtured, often over many years, simply vanish, one after the other. This is apparently the case with the CIA, as a cable from the agency's counterintelligence said America's Central Intelligence Agency has lost too many of the people it recruited from other countries to spy for the United States in recent years. This news raises some very important questions, like, has the CIA lost its touch? Is the agency doing enough to protect the informants it recruits in foreign countries? And are the CIA's rivals getting ahead of American spies?
Mr. Amir Rahimpour, who was arrested for spying for the CIA, had established links with a spy service, received large salaries, and tried to provide information about the nuclear power of the Islamic Republic of Iran for the American service. He was uncovered, tried, and sentenced to death. And the country's Supreme Court recently confirmed the verdict of this American spy.
The cable's report matches the news coming out every now and then about CIA sources who were arrested or executed. In fact, it's not a new issue. The agency has lost so many spies in Iran. For example, in 2019, Iranian officials said they had arrested 17 people who were working for the CIA in Iran. In another example, the agency had to curb its spying in Lebanon in 2011 after the arrest of several informants in Beirut. China also once in one operation captured some 20 CIA spies. The story was widely publicized in 2018. And there's another issue. It's not just about hunting down agents and capturing them. Many adversarial intelligence services in countries such as Russia, China, Iran, and Pakistan have been turning the CIA sources into double agents.
Just a moment ago, on the ninth floor of the federal courthouse next door, a former CIA case officer, one of those individuals entrusted with protecting our nation and its secrets, was just sentenced to 19 years in prison. Jerry Chun Sing Lee joins Ames, Regan, Pitts, and Mallory on the wall of infamous traitors prosecuted here in the Eastern District of Virginia. For arguably $840,000, Lee sold out the United States. He abused the trust that his superiors, the U.S. government, and frankly, the people of the United States placed in him.
Sometimes it's not even an intelligence agency, but a terrorist group with limited resources that do this. The 2009 bombing at a CIA base in Afghanistan's Khost is a good example. A Jordanian doctor the CIA thought it had convinced against al-Qaeda had in fact turned against the United States. The man blew himself up and seven CIA agents were killed. The same CIA that was responsible for numerous coups and chaotic political shifts in the world now seems that the agency's skills in training informants or thwarting rivals have become old and rusty. At the same time, CIA rivals have become more powerful and focused. It's not that the agency is not focused on training its spies, but many former officials believe the focus of the CIA is now on what it calls terrorist threats at countries that the US has invaded in the past two decades, like Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. They also say that the agency tends to underestimate foreign intelligence agencies and moves too quickly to recruit spies without considering counterintelligence risks.
I guess what I would say at the start is that, you know, I think we have to be clear-eyed about the reality, looking at the potential terrorism challenge, that both al-Qaeda and ISIS in Afghanistan remain intent on recovering the ability to attack U.S. targets, whether it's in the region, in the West, or ultimately in the homeland. After years of sustained counterterrorism pressure, the reality is that neither of them have that capacity today. and that there are terrorist groups, whether it's Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula or in other parts of the world, who represent much more serious threats today.
Another problem of the CIA is the technology revolution. There was a time when the United States was among a few countries that possessed high-tech gadgets and systems that aided its agents on their spy missions. Now, every country is developing its own spyware, gadgets, and data-gathering tools. The CIA's traditional human intelligence model can't survive the digital age. And it's not just about the CIA. No intelligence agency can survive on its old methods.
If confirmed, four crucial and interrelated priorities will shape my approach to leading CIA: China, technology, people, and partnerships. As President Biden has underscored, outcompeting China will be key to our national security in the decades ahead. That will require a long-term, clear-eyed, bipartisan strategy.
Nearly everyone agrees that social media, cell phones, facial recognition technology, and supercomputers that crunch big data have dramatically complicated the business of espionage. The technology revolution has made it all but impossible to maintain false identities and disguise relationships. In other words, the CIA's decades-old spying model has been overtaken by technology. There are many intelligence officials that strongly believe that with careful planning and professional operation, covert intelligence gathering by agents and others can still work. But history has shown time and again that even the most carefully planned operations can be uncovered with the help of technology. In 2010, a high-ranking member of the Hamas resistance movement, Mahmoud al-Mabhouh, was found dead in his hotel room in Dubai. It took Dubai police less than a month to find those behind the killing and expose them. It was a plot by Israeli intelligence to assassinate Mabhouh. Dubai police uncovered the plot by assembling CCTV videos of the Mossad agents. The Israeli team used a method called solid tradecraft, and technology exposed them. The most recent example is the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi journalist who was brutally killed and dismembered in Istanbul. The story of his assassination by rough agents hired by the Saudi crown prince filled the internet in less than a week after his disappearance. CCTV footage, facial recognition tools, and phone records revealed everything. So the technology revolution is not only the problem of the CIA, but every other intelligence agency in the world. But how is it that it cost the CIA so many spies? Is the US intelligence agency incapable of protecting its agents? If so, is there a guarantee that it can recruit spies in the future? Nobody wants to gamble their lives by becoming an informant at risk of exposure. So the agency might experience difficulties in convincing people to commit treason and work for them in their own countries. Of course, the CIA has never relied on any spies for collecting information. It has many ways to gather data for its analysts, to craft into briefings for policymakers. But the networks of humanists around the world are very much the centerpiece of CIA's efforts. The kind of intelligence that the agency is supposed to be the best in the world at collecting and analyzing. Former officials of the agency say recruiting new informants is how the CIA officers earn promotions, and judging by the recent Cable report, it's safe to say the CIA officers are not doing the very best they can. Or maybe they do, they're just not good enough, or maybe the rivals are just better than them.
A year has passed since immigrant rights advocates filed a federal complaint about human rights violations, including invasive gynecological procedures without full consent being performed on women at an immigration prison in Georgia. But The survivors of these abuses are still waiting for justice and restitution. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Priyanka Bhatt, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Survivors of Medical Abuse at ICE Jail in Georgia are still waiting for justice. Stay tuned for more. A year has passed since immigrant rights advocates filed a federal complaint about human rights violations, including invasive gynecological procedures without full consent being performed on women at an immigration prison in Georgia, but the survivors of these abuses are still waiting for justice and restitution. The federal complaint made international headlines for advocates filed it with the Department of Homeland Security Office of Inspector General, detailing horrific accounts from detained immigrants and whistleblower nurse Don Wooten. Even so, there have been grossly inadequate actions taken to hold Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, accountable for these abuses. While the Department of Homeland Security ordered the ICE contract at Irving County Detention Center to be terminated in May 2021, the prison still remains open. Worse yet, the immigrants who were previously detained at Irving were transferred to other deadly ICE prisons in Georgia, despite calls from advocates to release them. While House Resolution 1153 passed in October 2020, condemning the invasive non-consensual procedures and calling for full cooperation into investigations of Irving County Detention Center, there have been no congressional hearings and no update on the status of the original Office of Inspector General complaint filed. The survivors of Irving County Detention Center deserve justice in the form of closure of Irving County Detention Center along with all ICE prisons, immediate accountability for the violations that occurred in ICE custody, immigration relief, and reparations. Georgia is home to three ICE prisons where eight immigrants have died in the past 4 years. There have been documented abuses affecting thousands of detained immigrants, ranging from medical neglect to forced labor. These horrible conditions can be attributed, at least in part, to a subculture of bigotry within the state that has created legal detention pipelines like anti-immigrant state laws and 287 programs that funnel immigrants into ICE prisons for minor infractions and deny them equity and opportunity. Wendy Dow is one of the survivors of that system and of an invasive non-consensual gynecological procedure while incarcerated at the Irving County Detention Center. A black immigrant from Jamaica, Dow lived in Georgia for more than a decade, always in fear of the overly aggressive targeting of immigrants by law enforcement. A report on law enforcement in Gwinnett County, where Dow lived, documented a pattern of racial profiling where immigrants often reported being stopped without probable cause or reasonable suspicion. In addition to being subjected to warrantless searches, Dow was attacked by police dogs. While police looked on, I kept telling the police to get the dogs off me, but they waited until my legs and fingers were beaten up for no particular reason, Dow recalls. That incident led to her arrest and transfer to ICE custody. But nothing prepared her for the grim realities of the Irving County Detention Center. The stress of being confined in treacherous conditions and separated from her children led to spikes in blood pressure and vision problems. One day, while showering, Dow fell, hit her head, and fainted. Despite being in terrible pain, she was not transferred to an outside hospital because she was told she didn't have any broken bones. This lack of care is common at the Irvine County Detention Center. But the worst was yet to come. During a gynecology appointment, Dow had been told that she had cysts in her stomach that needed to be treated. Very early one morning, weeks later, she was abruptly woken up and told to get dressed to go to see a doctor. Dow assumed the visit concerned her high blood pressure, but instead, she was taken to a hospital and told she was having surgery to remove cysts from her stomach. She was given no other explanation. When Dow woke up from surgery, she was back at the Irvine County Detention Center. There were bandages on my stomach and pain on my sides and under my navel, Dow recalls. At Irvine, no one would tell her what procedure she had been subjected to, and no one provided any medication for the terrible pain, even as the wound became infected, leaking yellow pus. To them, I was another person without documents. I was nobody, she says, adding, I was scared of not coming out. I wrote a will to my brother telling him what to do with my children because I felt like I wasn't going to come out alive. Of course, Dow is one of at least 40 Irvine County Detention Center survivors who underwent invasive procedures without their full knowledge and consent. In a recently published report, another survivor shared that after finding out her fallopian tube had been removed without her consent, she was extremely distressed and suffered periods of depression and anger, knowing that she could not naturally conceive children anymore. Yet another survivor noted that her appointment that she felt pain like childbirth and felt like her was rotting from inside. The threat of a state-sanctioned violence against women's bodies, and in particular black and brown communities, is unfortunately not new to the Peach State. Georgia was the 32nd state to pass a sterilization law in 1937 and sterilized more than 3,000 individuals, the fifth highest in the country. Eugenics politics across U.S. legalized pseudoscientific practices used primarily by white elites to control black or indigenous people, immigrants, poor women, and people with disabilities who they believed were unfit or feeble-minded. These white supremacist policies continue today in many different forms, including in ICE practices and xenophobic anti-black legislation. Just like the Georgia State Board of Eugenics in 1930s, the majority white male legislators of the current Georgia General Assembly often continue to make decisions that harm communities of color and women, from its passage of Jim Crow voter suppression bill to a draconian anti-abortion bill and scores of anti-immigrant bills. The road to accountability and reparations for these abuses promises to be long and grueling. I'm speaking out to bring awareness to us women, mother, daughters who got abused at the hands of ICE so that it doesn't happen to anyone else, Dow says, adding, I would like to hold the U.S. government, ICE, and the Irvine staff and doctors accountable for what happened to us and to all others, physically, mentally, and emotionally. I'm calling for justice.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, IRIB English Radio listeners. Welcome to Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are based on quotes from the Holy Quran and narrations from the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Today we have Brother Abdullah Al-Musawi here in the studio. Thank you for joining us, Brother Al-Musawi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you. Right, so our topic for today is how to make my child happy in a responsible and Islamic way. So, Brother Al-Musawi, what do you have?
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan al-la'in ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil faraja. One thing we need to keep in mind as parents or as educators is that happiness, it's a feeling that is felt within us, from within side, not from within outside. So the child, he might express his happiness through, I don't know, a smile, being joyous, playing, his actions, or the way he deals with his family members.
Yeah.
So when we talk about emotions, and especially happiness as an emotion, we have to understand that it stems from within the child himself. So in order to make a child, you need to tap inside his inner mentality rather than his external bodily
physical
desire, yeah, physical aspect of things. So sometimes we give them gifts, we buy them clothes, we give them food, we give them the best of everything, and we're thinking that we're making our children happy. But in fact, they're not. That's not how children become happy at all. And sometimes, even as a parent, you say, well, I've given him everything. I bought him a PlayStation, for example. I bought him a PC. I got him a tablet. I got him this.
But all these are materialistic
very
things,
materialistic.
Right? They don't have like true meaning.
It does not at all. It doesn't make a child happy. And for example, you see the child actually through what you've given him so much, he's the one in control of you. You're no longer the one in control of him, because he can get whatever he wants from you.
Yeah.
But sometimes the children themselves, they have a need from within them. For example, to be appreciated, to be at least noticed in their houses, that when they do something wrong, for example, how you deal with them is also, to them, makes a huge difference.
I notice sometimes the child also does, you know, wrong things, you know, as a cry for help, really. He's trying to get the attention of the parents, like you said.
It is. So this is something that I was going to mention anyway. So you can see that the children, when it comes to expressing their feelings, since they can't and they're not seeing what they require from a parent, if they're not getting the right attention,
yeah,
or the right respect, as even psychologists say that a child at the age of 2, he starts to develop his personality. And at that age, he would want to be recognized. He would want to be dealt with as an existential creature,
yeah,
that someone that has feelings,
being, because characteristics.
Yeah. So sometimes
personality, right?
Yeah.